This is Audible.
Audiobooks.com presents A Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts by Andrew Chaikin, with a foreword by Tom Hanks, read for you by Bronson Pinchot. Foreword, Tom Hanks. I was captured by the spirit of the Apollo program when I was 12 years old. I had been following the space program throughout the Mercury and Gemini flights, building model kits and watching the launches from my mom's house in Northern California. We had an above-ground pool in the backyard, and I would put a brick in the back of my swim trunks to hold me down on the bottom, suck in air through a garden hose, and lay there with my arms and legs adrift, pretending I was walking in space. I was, of course, eagerly anticipating the Apollo missions to the moon because that would give me more models to build. But it wasn't until the lunar orbit flight of Apollo 8 at Christmas time 1968 that I really recognized what was happening. Mankind was leaving Earth for the first time in history. I thought about the three astronauts traveling all that distance and wondered what they felt and what they must have seen. I'll never forget the telecast they made as they circled the moon Christmas Eve and their reading from the book of Genesis. It was a perfect moment that captured the romantic, epic, historic adventure of it all. I returned to that adventure in 1994 for the filming of Apollo 13. In preparing for the role of astronaut Jim Lovell, who, appropriately, had also been aboard Apollo 8, I realized there was a great deal about the Apollo program that had never been brought to light, things that I did not know. I wanted to understand the events that enabled Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to make the first landing on the moon. I also wanted to know what went on when other men, like Pete Conrad, Al Bean, Dave Scott, Jack Schmidt, and Gene Cernan, made their footprints in the lunar soil in the five landings that came afterward. I wanted the whole story of mankind's exploration of the moon. I found it in Andy Chaikin's impressive and illuminating book, A Man on the Moon. It had just come out. I picked it up and read it straight through. It was fascinating, just great stuff. What I enjoyed most was the way Andy captured the personalities of the men themselves. Not just what they did, but who they were and what made them take on the job of flying to the moon. At the same time, he did a great job of describing the nuts and bolts of how we got there. I am, quite frankly, not a rocket scientist. I only played one in a movie. I had been confused by the technology of Apollo, but here it was, explained in a way that I could understand and that was, above all, entertaining. Even the moon itself, full of mystery and spectacular scenery, was an ongoing character in a grand scientific detective story. A Man on the Moon showed me that each of the missions was fraught with peril, and each accomplished things that were of stellar importance to humanity. Each was an example of the best part of us all. The only thing that is disappointing about the Apollo story is that it comes to an end. Our work on the moon was halted after the Apollo 17 mission in December 1972. I have the secret hope that the story is only Volume 1, with Volume 2 coming soon. Late in the winter of 1995, after Apollo 13 had finished filming, I read Andy's book again, this time for sheer pleasure. By then, I had met many of the people I was reading about, and that gave the stories new meaning and immediacy. And I began playing with the idea of bringing the entire Apollo saga to television in a dramatic, episodic event, something like a combination of Brideshead Revisited and the Civil War, by way of all those official NASA mission recap films. Not long afterward, I called Andy, whom I had met on the set of Apollo 13. By summer, work on the series for HBO, From the Earth to the Moon, had begun. As my colleagues became immersed in the task of putting Apollo on film, excerpts from A Man on the Moon were the first things in our reference binders. The big challenge we faced was to make each new mission as interesting as the one before, to give each episode of the series its own unique, dramatic narrative and theme. Often, these themes came right out of what Andy writes about, or hints at, in the book's pages. When there was a question of accuracy or accomplishment, someone on the staff always asked the most obvious question, "What does Chaikin say about this?" What I hope to convey with From the Earth to the Moon is what Andy's captured so well in this book, just how magnificent an undertaking Apollo really was, that going to the moon was not just a technological endeavor, but an artistic one, like Michelangelo's frescoes on the Sistine Chapel ceiling. The same kind of imagination that allowed Michelangelo to produce the crowning achievement of his era helped NASA's engineers build their moonships. Just as Michelangelo needed faith in his own abilities to sustain him during the long years of his effort, so faith was at the heart of what it took to put men and their shoes and socks and pictures of their children on the surface of the moon. Above all, Apollo was a voyage of inspiration. The thing that still fuels me in my day-to-day life, and what I want to convey to my children and to the audience, is that if mankind can figure out a way to put 12 men on the moon, then honestly, we can solve anything. That's why, I believe, the 6 Apollo landings are 6 of the 7 greatest stories ever told. Preface. The 60s were a time of cultural earthquakes. The horror of the Kennedy and King assassinations, the arrival of 4 mop-topped singers from Liverpool, the flower-fragrant summer of love, the din of protest, and, most of all, the violence of the war in Vietnam. And something else extraordinary happened. On the night of July 20th, 1969, 2 Americans walked on the moon. In what seemed like a miracle of technology, we witnessed it live on television. Across the country, 400,000 people who had worked to make it happen celebrated their triumph. TV commentators and editorial writers proclaimed that 500 years from now, our century would be remembered for those footsteps, when human beings left their home planet to explore the universe. But in our own time, their impact was fleeting. Even as astronauts returned to the moon for bolder and more ambitious explorations, our attention was diverted. While the nation was absorbed in the war, the environment, and unrest at home, NASA was expanding the reach of human beings on another world. On Apollo 11, the first lunar landing, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had spent little more than a day on a bland acre of moonscape. In their single moonwalk, which lasted a bit longer than a feature-length film, they never ventured more than a couple of 100 feet from their lander. By 1972, the final pair of moonwalkers, Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt, were living for 3 full days on the moon, exploring a lunar valley ringed by spectacular mountains whose rocks would provide a key to the origin of the solar system. During 3 moonwalks, each lasting more than 7 hours, they drove more than 10 miles in a battery-powered car. Their activities were broadcast live, in color, and with remarkable clarity by a TV camera that was remotely controlled from Earth. But we had stopped watching. We have never really come to terms with what we saw on that summer night 25 years ago, or with the events that followed. In large measure, it is because we never really understood what had happened. TV showed us what the astronauts did on the moon, but could not transmit the immensity of the venture. The astronauts knew this, and when they returned to Earth, they struggled to describe their experiences. But astronauts are not communicators, and with rare exceptions, their words could not bridge the gap between the high-tech realm of spaceflight and everyday experience. The real impact of Apollo, the experiences of the first men to visit another world, remained, like the moon itself, beyond our grasp. I was 13 when Armstrong and Aldrin landed on the moon. Like countless other space-struck teenagers, I kept a daily vigil in front of the TV, surrounded by press kits, lunar maps, and scale models of rockets and spacecraft. That passion stayed with me when I embarked on a science journalism career, writing articles on astronomy and space exploration as an editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. The space shuttle era had arrived, but for me, it was Apollo that held special fascination. By 1984, I had interviewed Gene Kranz, the flight director who had been in the trenches of mission control during the first lunar landing, and Harvard geologist Clifford Frondell, who had been present when the first box of moon rocks was opened inside the windowless expanse of NASA's Lunar Receiving Laboratory. For an article on space motion sickness, I had experienced weightlessness aboard a special NASA cargo plane used for astronaut training. I had tried on a lunar spacesuit and flown the Apollo Command Module simulator. Without realizing it, I had been preparing myself to become a vicarious participant in the Apollo adventure. By the summer of 1984, the idea of a book about the moon experience began to take shape. To write it, I would need to talk at length to each of the 23 surviving moon voyagers. Apollo 13 astronaut Jack Swigert had died in 1982. The following year, I conducted the first interviews for the project with the crew of Apollo 12, Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, and Alan Bean. In 1986, I began to work on the book full-time, and my house became a museum of lunar exploration, panoramas of the moon on the walls, mission transcripts and debriefings on the bookshelves, Apollo videotapes in the VCR. At first, a number of the astronauts were reluctant to get involved. Some of the interviews came about only after years of perseverance. Not until 1992, 7 years after I began, did the last of the lunar veterans, Apollo 16's Ken Mattingly, sit down with me to tell his stories. The encounter was typical of the interviews on this project. We talked for 6 hours, in which time Mattingly vividly recounted his own unique lunar experiences. During the past 8 years, when people asked me what my book was about, I would say that it was the story of the lunar voyages that the astronauts never wrote. These men are such loners that the thought of all of them sitting down to write a book together seems more far-fetched than the idea that they have been to the moon. I hope that my efforts will serve in their stead to tell the story of a unique handful of men who have been to the edge of human experience. If we can know what it was like for them, if we can sense the men inside the spacesuits, then we can look back and see what really began on that July night 25 years ago. We touched the face of another world and became a people without limits. Andrew Chaikin, December 1993. Prologue. Wednesday, September 12th, 1962. Morning. Rice University, Houston, Texas. John Kennedy stood at the podium at Rice University Stadium in the heat of a Texas sun. He had come to Rice, on the outskirts of Houston, to help dedicate the National Aeronautics and Space Administration's new manned spacecraft center, 22 miles away. NASA's burgeoning facilities were proof that America's space program was being transformed from an experimental venture into a bold reach a quarter of a million miles across the void, and it was happening because Kennedy had said it should. Nearly 16 months earlier, in May 1961, the young president had stood before a joint session of Congress and in the calmest of words had stated the unthinkable. I believe this nation should commit itself, before this decade is out, to landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. Whatever Kennedy's words lacked in emotion, their impact was immediate. Human beings had barely taken their first toddling steps off the planet. NASA had just lofted Alan Shepard on a 15-minute suborbital flight. Now Kennedy was giving them less than 9 years to get to the moon, but the stakes were high. Space was the new battleground of the Cold War, and the Soviet Union was winning. In April, the Soviets had sent the first man into space. For Kennedy, that embarrassment was compounded a week later by the Bay of Pigs fiasco. Suddenly, nothing mattered more than beating the Soviets in space, and Kennedy's advisors told him only a race to land on the moon offered the U.S. a chance of victory. Within days after Shepard's flight, he had made his decision. In the past 16 months, as Kennedy's vision had materialized, so had the clarity of his purpose. To those who questioned this audacious venture, he would now give his answer. "Why choose this as our goal?" Kennedy asked his audience, and they may well ask, "Why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic?" "Why," he added, without missing a beat, "does Rice play Texas?" The crowd sat quietly in the heat, fanning themselves, mopping their brows, as Kennedy spelled out the technological hurdles that would have to be cleared to build the Apollo spacecraft and its Saturn V booster. With no hint of unease, he laid out the staggering costs of the venture. Already the space budget had increased to 40 cents per person per week for every man, woman, and child in the United States, more than the allocations of the previous 8 years combined, and soon it would be more than 50 cents. The effort would spawn new jobs, new knowledge, new technology, Kennedy said, but ultimately the first voyages to another world would be, in some measure, an act of faith and vision, for we do not know what benefits await us. And if the road to the moon seemed long in 1962, there were men and women in this audience who would dedicate themselves to traveling it, and Kennedy's words were fuel for their young, ambitious hearts. "We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard." His voice rang with energy and confidence. His words soared above the sound of applause. "Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our abilities and skills, because that challenge is one that we are willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one which we intend to win." Afternoon, Miramar Naval Air Station, San Diego, California. The howl of jet engines enveloped Pete Conrad as he climbed out of his Phantom supersonic fighter, the energy of the flight still inside him. It was past 4 in the afternoon, and Conrad planned to change out of his flight gear and head straight home. But when he reached the ready room, there was a message waiting for him from NASA's Deke Slayton in Houston. Conrad wouldn't let himself believe the thought that flashed through his mind, that Slayton's call would change his life. At age 32, Navy Lieutenant Charles Pete Conrad had already made a name for himself as one of the most gifted test pilots in the country. He'd come to Miramar from the Navy's flight test school at Patuxent River, Maryland, where he was known as a superb stick-and-rudder man and a fine instructor. Recently, he'd requalified for night carrier landings, the hairiest, most demanding flying in the Navy or anywhere else for his money. It was carrier flying that prompted Navy flyers to call themselves aviators instead of just pilots. Now Conrad was cleared for combat operations. Soon he and the rest of Fighter Squadron 96 would deploy with the aircraft carrier Ranger on a training mission in the Pacific. Since joining the squadron here at Miramar, Conrad had begun to think about leaving the Navy. Mostly, it came down to money. He had 4 boys to put through college someday, and the pay for test pilots was better in industry. Back in June, he'd sent inquiring letters to several aerospace companies, but in 1962 there were few industry jobs for test pilots. His only offer came from North American Aviation in Columbus, Ohio, where they were building the new A-3J Vigilante attack plane. Conrad thought hard about the job and decided it was too risky. If he went to Columbus and the Vigilante program didn't come through, he'd end up in pilot purgatory, flying a twin Beechcraft for some corporate president for the rest of his days. In the end, he'd figured, the Navy wasn't such a bad deal after all. For one thing, there was job security, and the flying, that was wonderful. Nothing in life mattered more to Conrad than flying. If anyone had lived the made-to-order childhood of a fighter pilot, Pete Conrad had. At the age of 5, his father took him to a country fair in Ambler, Pennsylvania, where someone was selling rides in a small Waco cabin plane. The boy badgered his father into paying for a ride, then scrambled into the front seat ahead of everyone else. When the old Waco climbed into the blue, Conrad felt as if he belonged there. From then on, flying became his obsession. Growing up in the mainline suburbs of Philadelphia, he would sit for hours in cockpits he made from grocery crates and upended chairs, pretending to be Lindbergh flying the Atlantic or Eddie Rickenbacker in a World War I dogfight. As a teenager, he hung around at the local airport, doing odd jobs in exchange for flying lessons. A little too often, in fact, for his parents, who shipped him off to boarding school for a year to keep him out of the sky. But he returned in time to earn his private pilot's license on his 17th birthday. As an undergraduate at Princeton, Conrad entered the Navy with an eye toward becoming a naval aviator. After graduation, he had started down the road that brought him here, to the ranks of the top military pilots in the country. But that wasn't as high as a pilot could go. Not anymore. And therein lay the one disappointment in Conrad's past. In 1959, Conrad had been one of 69 young flyers who received secret orders to report to Washington, where they were told about Project Mercury, the country's high-priority effort to put a man in space. 37 of the pilots decided not to volunteer. The remaining 32, including Conrad, went on to the Lovelace Clinic in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for a week of exhaustive medical tests. Conrad ran the treadmill. He breathed into a bag while pedaling a stationary bike. His body was subjected to every conceivable invasion and indignity. They measured everything from his IQ to the length of his lower intestine. Conrad began to think NASA was looking for superb medical specimens even more than piloting skills. And his body did not fail him. Having run the doctor's gauntlet, Conrad moved on to the psychologists at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. For them, he stared at ink blots and pictures and made up stories about them. Looking back, he came to realize it was the psychologists who did him in. He didn't take all their hocus-pocus seriously enough. When they showed him a blank card, he studied it for a moment and deadpanned, "It's upside down." Then came endurance tests of all sorts. He was locked in a dark room, baked in a heat chamber, frozen, shaken, and whirled. When it was all over, Conrad had made it to the final cut, along with an old classmate from Pax River, Wally Schirra. Finally, NASA announced that 7 men had been chosen as the nation's first astronauts. Wally Schirra was one of them. Pete Conrad was not. Maybe it was just as well. During the selection process, Schirra and some of the other Navy pilots had gotten to talking, and they had doubts about the whole astronaut program. The stated objective of Project Mercury was to demonstrate that human beings could survive in space. The astronauts would be America's, and perhaps the world's, first space travelers. But would they really be pilots or just passengers? And what about after the project was over? They'd go back to the Navy, and who could say what effect the whole episode would have on their flying careers? Conrad, for one, wasn't sure that having flown around the Earth a couple of times would do him much good. He returned to Pax and put the whole astronaut business behind him. In the years that followed, he watched from the sidelines as the Mercury astronauts soared into the limelight and then into space. If he had any lingering doubts about the program, they vanished on February 20, 1962, the day John Glenn became the first American in orbit. While Glenn circled the Earth once every 90 minutes, 100 miles up, higher and faster than any jet pilot, Conrad was flying his Phantom over the Pacific. When Glenn splashed down, there was an announcement over the Navy radio, and Conrad, in his supersonic jet, felt a sharp pang of envy. By that time, the astronaut program was headed places Conrad never dreamed of. NASA was going to the moon. By the spring of 1962, NASA put out a call for more astronauts. This time, applications were to be made on a voluntary basis. The new selection amounted to a filling of the roster for the most challenging and historic test flights of all time. However slim his chances might be, Conrad couldn't pass up the opportunity to apply. At Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio, Conrad was pleasantly surprised to find the psychologists much less in evidence. They seemed to have been replaced by the FBI, if the number of background checks was any indication. Still, When it was all over, Conrad headed back to Miramar, fully expecting to be rejected a second time. The moon would be for John Glenn and Wally Schirra, but not for him. The ready room, a large space with enough well-worn chairs for the entire squadron of 30 during a briefing, was nearly deserted. One wall was all windows, looking out on the flight line. At the opposite wall, a couple of pilots lingered by a row of gray equipment lockers. The duty officer was at his desk. Everyone knew about the impending astronaut selection, and when Conrad came in, they excitedly told him about the phone call from Slayton. He thought it was a joke, until he held the message in his hand. Conrad sat on the edge of the duty officer's desk and borrowed the phone to call Houston. Slayton came on the line, and the two men exchanged some brief pleasantries. Then, in the quiet, understated tone that fighter pilots often use, Slayton asked Conrad the question he would remember for the rest of his life. "How would you like to come fly for us?" Conrad almost fell over. He was not to tell anyone, Slayton instructed him. NASA wanted everything kept quiet until the official announcement the following week. He was to report to Houston on October 1st. Conrad thanked Slayton and hung up, doing his best to hide his elation. He said nothing to the men in the ready room. He did not phone his wife. He changed into his khakis, got in his car, and started the 18-mile drive home. In his excitement, he almost wrecked the car. On that drive, it hit him for the first time that he was going to have a chance to go to the moon. He thought about the others who had been selected. He didn't know who they were, but he found himself wondering, if they really did this thing, how would it affect them? The Mercury pilots walked in the white-hot glare of celebrity even before they flew. When they splashed down, they rode into a shower of ticker tape. They mingled with the Kennedys. What would it be like for the ones who came back from the moon? Conrad drove on, thinking about the incredible path his life had just taken. Back when he was at Pax River, a woman who lived across the street started calling him Moon Man. And that was before there even was an astronaut program. Back then he was just a test pilot who loved to fly. Now he was aiming for the moon after all. And he promised himself, "It's not going to change me." Book 1 Chapter 1 Fire in the Cockpit. When the moon rises beyond the Atlantic shore of Florida, full and luminous, it seems so close that you could just row out to the end of the water and touch it. In January 1967, the moon seemed to draw nearer by the day to the hard, flat beaches of Cape Kennedy. Seen from there, it was no longer the governess of the tides, the lover's beacon, the celebrated mistress of song. It was a target, a Cold War beachhead in the sky. It was NASA's moon. Almost 6 years had passed since John Kennedy's challenge for a lunar landing by decade's end. The moon program had grown into an effort whose size and complexity dwarfed even the Manhattan Project. At aerospace contractors around the country, 400,000 people were hard at work on the moon ships for Project Apollo. Meanwhile, Project Gemini had just come to a spectacular finale. These two-manned missions had bridged the gap between the pioneering Mercury flights and the challenge of the lunar landing. For the first time in the race to the moon, the United States appeared to have pulled ahead of the Soviet Union. With the first manned Earth-orbit Apollo flight scheduled for mid-February, all seemed on target to make Kennedy's vision a reality. But one evening, late in January, that soaring optimism suddenly, terribly fell to earth. January 27, 1967, Merritt Island Launch Area, Kennedy Space Center, Cape Kennedy, Florida. How are we going to get to the moon if we can't talk between three buildings? Gus Grissom's voice was low and calm, but with an unmistakable edge of irritation. A senior astronaut, veteran of two space missions, Grissom was the commander of the first manned Apollo flight set for February 1967. On this warm January afternoon, Grissom and his crew, veteran astronaut Ed White and a rookie named Roger Chaffee were participating in a simulated countdown, the kind of routine test that preceded every mission. They were sealed inside the cone-shaped Apollo 1 command module, high atop a huge Saturn 1B booster rocket at Pad 34, one of dozens of launch complexes that lined the beach at Cape Kennedy. A few hundred yards away, inside the concrete bunker called the Saturn Blockhouse, some 200 members of the launch team heard Grissom's words. At the capsule communicator, or Stony console, a young rookie astronaut named Stuart Roosa tried in vain to answer. "Apollo 1, this is Stony. How do you read?" In 1967, there were so many astronauts that Grissom and Roosa hardly knew each other, but the younger man could hear the barely contained exasperation in Grissom's voice. "I can't hear a thing you're saying. Jesus Christ," I said, "how are we going to get to the moon if we can't talk between two or three buildings?" No one who knew Gus Grissom took him lightly. Small and powerful, he was known as a fierce competitor. When Grissom was a young Air Force fighter pilot in the Korean War, the flyers would ride an old school bus from the hangar to the flight line. Only those who had been in air-to-air combat could sit down. The uninitiated pilots had to stand. Grissom stood only once. He brought the same hard-driving determination to his spaceflight career as one of the Mercury astronauts known as the Original Seven. Even among these most elite flyers, the Seven had a status approaching royalty. Despite their rivalries, they had a unique bond that came from being the first Americans to venture into the heavens. Everything the Original Seven did was energized with competition, from flying airplanes to their impromptu drag races on straight Florida roads to their adventures in the night spots of Cocoa Beach, and Grissom was always a zealous participant. But even to other astronauts, Grissom was not an easy man to know. He was a loner among loners. In 1967, Gus Grissom stood at the top of the active roster of astronauts, but he had started out as something of an underdog. His first spaceflight, a suborbital Mercury mission in 1961, ended in near disaster when the hatch of his tiny spacecraft, Liberty Bell 7, blew off prematurely after splashdown in the Atlantic. Liberty Bell sank. Grissom narrowly escaped drowning. He maintained it had been a malfunction, that the hatch had blown off by itself, but somehow there had been a lingering skepticism in the press, at NASA, even among other astronauts. The doubts infuriated him. He fought to make up for that image. In 1965, after helping to design the two-man Gemini spacecraft, he commanded its successful first flight. Now, at age 40, after more than a year immersed in the development and testing of the Apollo command module, he would fly its maiden voyage in Earth orbit. Commanding the first flight of any new craft was always a prize assignment. But Grissom's ambitions didn't end there. He had his sights on the most coveted mission of all, the lunar landing. More than anything, Grissom wanted to be the first man on the moon. But on January 27th, the moon seemed a long way off. For several months now, Grissom had worked to help ready his spacecraft for its mission, and he had become more and more displeased with the way things were going. When engineering problems came up, he pushed for better solutions using his experience from Mercury and Gemini, but no one seemed to be listening. It made him so mad, he confided to an interviewer, he couldn't see straight. By the time the Apollo 1 command module left the factory in Downey, California, last August, it still had dozens of separate discrepancies, some of them serious. To make matters worse, the command module simulator here at the Cape was a constant source of difficulty. Just a few days ago, to show his frustration, he'd hung a big Texas lemon on it. Today, his patience was being strained once again by a trouble-plagued test. Despite all the frustrations, Grissom was pushing to get Apollo 1 into space on schedule. Not because he was reckless. Grissom hadn't lived this long by being reckless, but because problems were to be expected in any new flight program, whether a new airplane or especially a moonship. Today's simulated countdown was nothing new. It wasn't considered dangerous. The Saturn booster was not fueled, or even difficult. But there was trouble almost from the time Grissom and his crew climbed into the command module cabin, around 1 p.m. First, there was an unidentified odor in the breathing oxygen that reminded Grissom of sour milk. That alone had held up the test for an hour. Finally, the problem was solved, and at 2:45 p.m., the pad crews installed the command module's heavy, two-piece hatch and sealed it shut. The spacecraft was pressurized with pure oxygen, just as it would be on launch day. Then came the communications trouble. By late afternoon, Rusa was able to converse with the men inside the sealed spacecraft, but there were problems with the voice link to the manned spaceflight operations building 5.5 miles away. In the blockhouse, controllers weighed the decision of whether to abort the test. They decided to continue. In the blockhouse, seated next to Rusa at the stony console, Deke Slayton listened as technicians tried to fix the faulty communications. Slayton was 43 years old. He had been a civilian for several years now, but he still carried himself with the quiet, serious demeanor he'd had as a young Air Force fighter pilot. Another member of the original Seven, Slayton was one of Gus Grissom's best friends, but their fortunes could not have been more different. Grissom was now a veteran of 2 space missions, while Slayton had been grounded since 1962 for a minor heart irregularity and was still waiting for his first chance to fly in space. Now, as chief of the Manned Spacecraft Center's Flight Crew Operations Directorate, Slayton's role included following astronauts through tests like this one. Slayton knew only too well that Grissom wasn't happy with the way things were going. He'd had breakfast with Grissom, White, and Chaffee this morning, along with Joe Shea, the hard-driving NASA manager in charge of the command module effort, and they were all running through the litany of troubles with Grissom's spacecraft. Malfunctions in the environmental control system, coolant leaks, faulty wiring. Grissom bemoaned the communications trouble that plagued almost every test. "If you don't believe it," Grissom told Shea, "you ought to get in there with us." Shea declined, largely because there was some question about whether technicians would be able to rig up an extra communications headset for him in time. But Slayton gave the matter some thought. There would be space for him to sit, in shirt sleeves, in the command module's lower equipment bay beneath the footrests. He was still weighing the idea around midday as Grissom, White, and Chaffee suited up. Slayton rode with them in the transfer van to Pad 34, and by the time they arrived, he had made his decision. He would be better off in the blockhouse, he told Grissom, where he could keep a close eye on the test. Years later, he would still wonder whether or not he made the right choice. By evening, as dusk settled onto the marshlands, technicians continued to troubleshoot the faulty communications. Searchlights came on, bathing the giant Saturn rocket in white light. Meanwhile, other events in the countdown continued. Apollo 1 was on its own electrical power now, just as it would be in the final minutes before liftoff. But the communications troubles were still unsolved, and at T-minus 10 minutes, the test director called a hold in the count. At 6:31 p.m., 11 minutes into the hold, Slayton was looking over the test schedule when he heard a brief, clipped transmission from Apollo 1. It sounded like fire. On the other side of the country, at the North American Aviation Plant in Downey, California, veteran astronauts Tom Stafford, John Young, and Gene Cernan were sealed inside the second Apollo command module in their own spacecraft test. Besides being the most experienced space crew yet assembled, Cernan had flown once before on Gemini. While Stafford and Young each had 2 missions under their belts, they had a camaraderie seldom matched on a space crew. Now the 3 men were assigned as the backup team for the second manned Apollo mission. This command module, like Grissom's, was a prototype called Block 1. It was never built to go to the moon, but was instead designed only to fly in Earth orbit on the first Apollo flights. An improved version called Block 2 was already being developed for the lunar missions, and last month NASA had decided that there would be only 1 Block 1 mission, Apollo 1. Stafford and his crew were here at North American, the prime contractor for the command module, to help provide engineering support for the activities at the Cape. The work on Block 1 had been frustrating, in part because of the atmosphere here at Downey. North American had some very competent people, but they had never built a manned spacecraft before. Bundles of wire on the command module floor were unprotected, making them susceptible to damage. There were so many changes made within the cabin that the workmen could barely keep track of them all. Wires were constantly being rerouted, black boxes replaced, and lately, astronauts had felt a strain in their relationship with the North American engineers, who had begun to resist their suggestions. It had been different during Gemini. That spacecraft, like Mercury, was the product of the McDonnell Aircraft Corporation in St. Louis, which had forged a harmonious relationship with NASA. The astronauts who visited the factory had no trouble making inputs into the design process, and if they had a problem, they could always take it to Mr. Mack himself, and he would get results. But Apollo wasn't like Gemini. The intimacy was gone now. There was no single boss who could respond to the astronauts' concerns. Now there were bosses scattered throughout this massive operation. Even within NASA, there was a disturbing lack of coordination. In Houston, some of the engineers in the Apollo program office acted as if Gemini had never existed. They had an arrogance that seemed to say, "We know this business better than you do." Experience from Gemini, Stafford's or anyone else's, seemed to make no impression on them. They rolled their eyes at those Apollo astronauts and their Gemini war stories. Trying to get through to them was like talking to the wall. All of them knew of the trouble with Block 1, but in the back of everyone's mind was the end-of-the-decade deadline for the lunar landing. However dissatisfied they were, Stafford and the other astronauts had been willing to put up with Block 1 for the first couple of flights in order to stay on schedule. Their feeling was, "Just get us airborne, we'll fly it." But on this day, Stafford wasn't so sure. Their test, too, was in trouble. Leaking coolant lines, short circuits. At one point, the hatch fell on Cernan's foot. "Go to the moon," Stafford growled. "This son of a bitch won't even make it into Earth orbit." Finally, Stafford stopped the test. When he climbed out of the spacecraft, an emergency call from the Cape was waiting for him. When Deke Slayton heard the report of fire from Apollo 1, his gaze shot to a nearby closed-circuit television monitor. It showed the picture from a camera pointed at the command module's hatch window. The window was filled with bright flame. Suddenly, there was another message from the spacecraft, this time quite clear in a voice of contained urgency. "We've got a fire in the cockpit." Slayton recognized the voice as Roger Chaffee's. Chaffee was on the right side of the spacecraft, where the radio controls were. It was his job, in an emergency, to maintain contact with the blockhouse. On the television monitor, Slayton could see Ed White's arms reaching back over his head, trying to undo the bolts that held the side hatch shut. Neither Slayton nor anyone else in the blockhouse fully understood what was happening. Slayton would say later that his main concern was not fire but smoke. But now Slayton heard another voice, clearly frantic. "We've got a bad fire. We're burning up." At first, Slayton thought it was pad leader Don Babbitt, stationed next to the spacecraft, calling for help. Later, on the tapes, listeners identified the voice as Chaffee's. Seconds later, less than half a minute after the first report of fire, Slayton and the horrified controllers heard the last transmission from Apollo 1. It was a brief cry of pain. Long seconds passed. Now the communications loop surged with activity as technicians struggled to get the hatch open. "It's too hot," you could hear them say. On the television monitor, through dense smoke, Slayton could see the pad crews approach the hatch only to be driven back by the intense heat. Roosa tried several times to reestablish contact with the crew with no response. Several long minutes elapsed before the hatch was finally opened, and a short time after that, the pad leader came on the communications loop with a terse and ominous transmission. "I'd better not describe what I see." Physicians Fred Kelly and Alan Harder were in the blockhouse, and Slayton instructed them to go to the pad. Then he put in a call to the manned spacecraft center in Houston to set up a command center and get word to the families in case things were as bad as he feared. After several minutes, the call came from the doctors, confirming what everyone had dreaded. Slayton made another call to Houston. Then he and Roosa left the blockhouse and headed to Pad 34. It was a slow Friday afternoon in the astronaut office at the manned spacecraft center. Here, 25 miles from downtown Houston, built on a flat, coastal prairie that had once been owned by a Texas oil man, was a collection of modern buildings, all dark glass and white stone, set among neatly manicured lawns and artificial duck ponds. Here and there a windowless training facility or a laboratory with massive cryogenic storage tanks hinted at the true nature of this place, but for the most part it looked more like the campus of a community college than a place where engineers, scientists, and astronauts were waging an all-out assault on the moon. The astronaut office was located on the top floor of the three-story structure called Building 4. On this Friday afternoon it was nearly deserted. Most of the astronauts were out of town, chasing down some piece of the Apollo effort at contractors' plants around the country. But a young rookie named Alan Bean was here. Although he had been an astronaut since 1963, like Roger Chaffee, he was a member of the third astronaut group, Bean was still waiting for his first chance to fly in space. A few months ago, Deke Slayton had named him as the astronaut office representative on the manned space station project that was planned for the early 1970s. Bean didn't always hear about the details of what was going on in Apollo, but he knew Grissom, White, and Chaffee were at the Cape, getting ready for their mission. Sometime before 6 p.m., the phone rang. It was one of the support people at the Cape. What he said sounded so strange that Bean did not at first understand. "We've lost the crew." The man's voice was quiet. Bean heard no anguish in it. He had to stop and think about the words. The crew was surely Grissom's. Were the people at the Cape having trouble finding them? Lost the crew? Bean answered, "Where do you think they've gone?" The voice stumbled over more words that didn't make sense. He just didn't seem to want to tell Bean what had really happened. It took a long time for him to say it. Grissom, White, and Chaffee were dead. Bean had barely hung up the phone when it rang again. This time it was Mike Collins, in Deke Slayton's office up in the administration building. Collins, acting as the astronaut office representative for the Friday afternoon staff meeting, had just heard the same news. Now there was no miscommunication, for it was one pilot talking to another, and both knew what needed to be done. They agreed that Bean would coordinate astronauts and wives to go to the homes of the dead pilots. Bean called his wife Sue and sent her to the home of Martha Chaffee until Collins could get there. Wally Schirra's wife, Joe, and Chuck Berry, the Space Center's chief physician, would go to Betty Grissom's. Neil Armstrong's wife, Jan, would go to her next-door neighbor, Pat White's, and Bill Anders, another member of the third group, and, like Bean, a rookie, would follow. El Lago was one of a handful of planned communities that had sprung up around the Space Center, scattered with ranch houses and crisscrossed with tidy streets winding through the greenery. Here was the space community's own suburb. Astronauts and NASA engineers and managers all lived next door to each other, and aside from the tourists who occasionally came by looking for some sign of an astronaut as if they were on a tour bus in Beverly Hills, and the mobs of reporters who, during missions, stood watch on an astronaut's lawn as if the Fisher quintuplets had just been born inside, there was nothing remarkable about the way it felt to live here. That was precisely the point. The residents of El Lago and of nearby Nassau Bay and Timber Cove and Clear Lake clung to normalcy in the midst of the most extraordinary enterprise of the 20th century. It was already dark when Bill Anders arrived at the ranch house belonging to Ed and Pat White. Normally, there wouldn't have been any reason for Anders to know White very well. The two had never been on a crew together, and they belonged to different astronaut groups. White, a Gemini veteran from the second group, Anders, a rookie from the third. Anders and his wife, Valerie, had gotten to know Ed and Pat White mostly because they lived one street apart. Even among the astronauts, Ed White had always stood out. A strapping six-footer who had barely missed becoming an Olympic hurdler, he was known as one of the finest physical specimens in the astronaut office. And perhaps more than any astronaut except John Glenn, White subscribed to their All-American image. In 1965, after he became the first American to walk in space, White easily wore the mantle of a national hero. There appeared to be no limit to how far he might go. Ed and Pat seemed perfectly matched. Few women were so devoted to their husbands. Now, Bill Anders would have to tell Pat White that her husband was dead. Bill Anders had lived with death for most of his adult life, first as an Air Force fighter pilot, then as an astronaut. He had been to his share of funerals. And it was at funerals that Anders had noticed something about himself that made him feel different from other people. He did not shed tears. While he felt sadness for the family, he did not grieve for the man who was killed. When he'd decided to become a fighter pilot, he'd accepted deadly risk as part of the bargain. And he knew the dead pilot would have felt the same way. Sure, it's a shame to lose a good man, but he knew what he was getting into. He flipped a coin and he lost. By 1967, death had become a part of the astronaut life. Just last year, Charlie Bassett and Elliot C. had been killed in a plane crash, and 2 years before that, it was Ted Freeman who perished the same way. And none of this had made Anders hesitate to climb into the cockpit of a supersonic jet fighter or trust his life to a pressure suit in the vacuum of a test chamber. It didn't blunt his desire to ride a moon rocket. Like all the astronauts, Anders accepted the risks of the job, and it wasn't difficult for him to do that. What was difficult, the hardest thing Anders would ever do, was to go to the house of this attractive woman in her 30s, who was raising 2 children, bearing bad news. A short while ago, Pat had picked up her daughter from a ballet lesson. When she arrived home, her neighbor Jan Armstrong was waiting silently for her. She must have been surprised, then confused. After all, Ed was at the Cape. He wasn't flying tonight. And then she must have filled with dread. But it wasn't up to one astronaut wife to tell another that her darkest nightmare had come true. That task, most often, fell to another astronaut. Anders rang the doorbell. When Slayton and Rusa arrived at Pad 34, ambulances waited in vain at the base of the huge launch tower, their rotating beacons flashing in the night. Entering the steel gridwork of the gantry, the 2 men boarded a small elevator and rode it to adjustable level A8, 218 feet up, and headed across the swing arm to the small enclosure at the other end, called the White Room. Even before they arrived, they were assaulted by the stench of burned electrical insulation and incinerated plastics. At last, reaching the end of the swing arm, they could see it. The command module's square hatchway, flush against the side of the White Room. Something was hanging from the open hatch. It was an arm, clad in a white spacesuit. Kelly and Harder, the 2 doctors, were here. They told Slayton the dead men were still inside, snared in a web of melted nylon netting that had once hung within the cabin. The doctors had been unable to remove them. Slayton gripped the rail just above the hatchway and leaned into the cabin of Apollo 1. He could see the familiar configuration of the command module cabin, 3 couches, side by side, the broad center instrument panel, amid a forest of switches, knobs, and controls. Warning lights still glowed amber on the blackened panel. Much of the once spotless cabin was covered with soot. On the right side of the cabin, Slayton could see Chaffee, his space-suited form motionless in his couch, still strapped in. The other 2 couches were empty. Slayton looked down, below the edge of the hatchway, and spotted 2 helmeted heads, both with clear faceplates, still closed. Right below the hatch were a pair of legs, doubled up, from which the layers of spacesuit material had been burned off. It was impossible to tell who was Grissom and who was White. Slayton told Kelly and Harter not to do anything more until photographs could be taken. Then he and Rusa turned away from the blackened cabin of Apollo 1, carrying the smell of fire and death with them. For the rest of their lives, even after the terrible images had faded in memory, they would remember that smell. The astronauts had always known it was only a matter of time. Gemini had had its share of close calls. None worse than when Gemini 8 began tumbling out of control. Neil Armstrong and Dave Scott had narrowly escaped with their lives, and the Gemini pilots had taken some calculated risks. For example, everyone knew that the Gemini ejection seat and parachute that served as the only means of escape in a launch emergency was effective only under very limited conditions. And there were other risks, not only on Gemini, but on the comparatively primitive Mercury flights. Looking back, it was not only superb hardware and outstanding people in space and on the ground that had averted tragedy, it was also luck. But the lunar missions were even more complex, and among the astronauts there was an unspoken feeling that it was only a matter of time before their luck ran out. Gus Grissom had known that. Sometime during Gemini, he had told his wife, "If there's ever a serious accident in the program, it's probably going to be me." And a few weeks ago, at a press conference, he had said, "If we die, we want people to accept it. We're in a risky business." But he was talking about dying in space. If Grissom, White, and Chaffee had burned up in re-entry, if they had perished in the fireball of an exploding booster, if their parachutes hadn't opened and they had plummeted into the ocean, any of those fates would have been easier to accept. The terrible shock of this January night. And the irony was that they died while their spacecraft was sitting on the pad, with technicians all around them, safety just on the other side of the hatch. And yet, no one had been able to save them. What went wrong? Even years after investigators began to sift through the wreckage of Apollo 1 piece by piece, no one could say exactly. But within weeks, the general picture became clear. The fire was a disaster waiting to happen. During the test, the command module was pressurized with pure oxygen at 16.7 pounds per square inch, slightly above sea-level atmospheric pressure. Pure oxygen can be a fire hazard even at low pressure, but at 16.7 psi, the danger grows to frightening proportions. And yet, the practice of pressurizing with oxygen on the pad had been used dozens of times during Mercury and Gemini without mishap. NASA had chosen pure oxygen for Apollo for the same reasons it had been used in Mercury and Gemini. It eliminated the weight and complexity that would have been required for an oxygen-nitrogen mixture. Pure oxygen was essential while in orbit, when the cabin pressure was only 5 psi. Somehow, no one had absorbed the realization that on the pad, the pressure was kept slightly above sea-level conditions, and if oxygen carried a fire risk, the command module's designers thought they had removed all possible sources of ignition from the command module cabin. But they were wrong. Shortly after 6:31 p.m. on January 27th, the review board concluded there was a spark inside Apollo 1, probably in the vicinity of some damaged wires in the lower equipment bay at the foot of Grissom's couch, perhaps aided by flammable fumes leaking from a nearby coolant pipe. The spark ignited some nylon netting that had been installed underneath the couches to catch dropped equipment, and the fire spread quickly. Other flammable items, including foam pads that were there to protect the interior finish during the test, fueled the blaze. Even materials normally considered flame-resistant burned as if they had been doused in kerosene. On the walls, Velcro fasteners, a favorite means of securing loose gear in weightlessness, exploded in a shower of fireballs. In seconds, as the temperature soared to 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, the command module became an incinerator, and Grissom, White, and Chaffee never had a hope of escape, because the hatch had become impossible to open. The command module side hatch was one of the inevitable design compromises. It was a two-piece affair, with an outer hatch and an inner hatch that opened inward into the cabin. Some NASA engineers and astronauts, and even engineers at North American, had questioned the design, calling for a one-piece hatch that could be swung open, like the one used in Gemini. But the Apollo managers, and Joe Shea in particular, always had sound reasons for vetoing the change. Mostly it was a matter of weight. Each pound of payload cost many times its own weight in propellant to haul it off the surface of the Earth and send it to the Moon. The two-piece hatch was not only the most lightweight design, it was also the simplest. And to anyone concerned about air leaks during a 2-week trip to the moon and back, an inward opening hatch solved the problem. Cabin pressure would keep it tightly sealed, but even under the best conditions, it was very difficult to open. The inner hatch was a heavy, cumbersome metal plate secured by a set of bolts. The man in the center couch had to reach back over his head, undo the bolts using a special tool, and then lower it out of the way. Ed White had been in Apollo 1's center couch, and no astronaut surpassed him for sheer physical strength. For exercise, White and his backup, Dave Scott, used to practice opening the hatch. It was like pressing a couple of 100 pounds at the gym. But only seconds after the fire started, neither Ed White nor any other human being would have been strong enough to open it. As the fire progressed, the buildup of hot gases sealed the hatch shut with thousands of pounds of force. As it was, White never had a chance even to undo the bolts. The blaze would undoubtedly have consumed the three men had it continued, but within 15 seconds after the first report of fire, the pressure in the cabin soared to nearly twice sea-level atmospheric pressure, high enough to rupture the command module's hull. Hot gases rushed through the breach with a loud whoosh that startled the pad crews, leaving the cabin enveloped in thick smoke. But by then, the horror of being trapped in an inferno was nearly over for Grissom's crew. Seconds later, their oxygen hoses burned through, and carbon monoxide forced its way into their spacesuits. 15 to 30 seconds after that, the medical examiners estimated, the men lost consciousness. Within 4 minutes, there was no hope of reviving them. Grissom, White, and Chaffee did not burn to death. They were asphyxiated. The greatest irony was that Gus Grissom, who had almost drowned after his Mercury mission because of a hatch that opened prematurely, was claimed by a hatch that could not be opened at all. Even the astronauts who did not see the charred spacecraft or smell its acrid odor in the Florida night were stunned by the news from the Cape that Friday evening. They were appalled to realize how much they had overlooked. They had talked about what they would do if a fire broke out while they were in space, how the flames might propagate in zero gravity, but none of them had even considered a fire on the pad. Like so many things about this disaster, it was almost beyond comprehension. In hindsight, there was enough blame to go around. Some astronauts, in anger, singled out North American, saying its engineers, yielding to schedule pressure, had taken shortcuts. And as the investigation of the fire progressed, there were charges of mismanagement and shoddy workmanship. Nor was NASA without fault. All of this had happened under the agency's supervision. But there was another, more forgiving view. True, North American wasn't like McDonnell, but no one had ever tried to assemble a moonship before. The Apollo command module was the most complex flying machine ever devised, an intricate package crammed full of state-of-the-art equipment. It would have been naive not to expect all kinds of things to go wrong the first time they put one together, and no one, at NASA or North American, had knowingly compromised the astronauts' safety. And in the next weeks, the astronauts came to admit what Stafford, Young, and Cernan did over a few drinks one night, that there was a hidden blessing in this disaster. The wreckage of Apollo 1 was there for the accident board to examine, not a silent tomb circling the Earth or drifting in the translunar void. Although 3 men had died, 3 or perhaps 6 more lives had probably been saved. On the cold, wet January day when they buried Grissom, White, and Chaffee, most of the astronauts put the tragedy of the fire behind them with an acceptance that was difficult for outsiders to understand. Ultimately, when Grissom had spoken of accepting death in a dangerous, critical undertaking, he had been speaking for all of them. Their biggest concern now was making Apollo fly. The immediate causes of the fire had to be fixed, and now there was a much-needed chance to correct the long list of other inadequacies. It would take time, but they had to recover and move on. Before them was the most extraordinary goal of the 20th century, and it came with a deadline.
Chapter 2.
The Office. April 1967, Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston. Deke Slayton stood in the small conference room on the third floor of Building 4, facing the collection of astronauts he had called together. In the spring of 1967, NASA was moving on from the tragedy that would always be known as the fire. Amid lingering criticism of the agency, the Accident Review Board had made its report to Congress. At the North American plant in California, a redesigned, fireproof Block 2 command module was under development, and now there was an astronaut, Gemini veteran Frank Borman, working hand-in-hand with new management. And here in Houston, it was time to get back to the business of making the end-of-the-decade deadline for the lunar landing. 18 astronauts waited for the meeting to begin. Slayton was not one for fanfare. "The guys who are going to fly the first lunar missions," he said, "are the guys in this room." At first glance, there was nothing remarkable about these men. Sometimes, when they walked the halls of the Space Center, clad in NASA blue flying coveralls, they were easy to spot. Here, dressed mostly in sports shirts and slacks, they wore a casual anonymity, but their trim bodies hinted at lives of self-discipline, and their eyes, quick and bright, revealed an unwavering concentration born of countless adventures in the air, in a profession in which the mind simply does not wander. To the people who worked with them, engineers, simulation instructors, flight controllers, they were just regular guys. But even they could not deny that there was something remarkable about who these men were, where they had been, and most of all, where they were going. Most of these 18 were veterans of the two-man Gemini flights of 1965 and 1966. Those missions, as bold as they were successful, had been their training ground for the moon. If the astronauts had been a squadron, Slayton would have been their wing commander. Sometimes, in conversation with each other, they called him Father Slayton. In 1959, a lifetime ago it seemed, there were just 7 men who called themselves astronauts, and Slayton had been one of them. He was considered one of the most gifted pilots of the original 7, but even now Slayton was still waiting for his first spaceflight. In 1962, only weeks before he was scheduled to become the second American in orbit, Slayton was abruptly grounded by the doctors. He had a condition called idiopathic paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. Every so often, for unknown reasons, his heartbeat became irregular. Slayton's protests that he felt absolutely fine and that his performance was unaffected were to no avail. NASA's administrator, James Webb, ruled that the agency couldn't take the risk of sending him into space. And that was not the end of Slayton's frustration. He was banned from flying an airplane by himself. Since then, while waging a lonely battle to get back on spaceflight status, Slayton had served as the Space Center's director of flight crew operations, managing the affairs of every pilot at the center, including the astronauts. From his office on the 9th floor of the administration building, he oversaw just about everything the astronauts did, from training to business trips to public appearances. In the most difficult of ironies, it was Slayton who picked the crew for every mission. He would have given anything to join them, to trade his executive suite for a government-issue desk in the astronaut office, and they knew it. There is no record of how the astronauts reacted to Slayton's announcement. Probably they said nothing. To some, Slayton's words came as welcome reassurance. For others, they were not news. For a handful, the rookies, just being in this room at all was reward enough. It meant an end to years.